You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
This is a terrible, ghastly global catastrophe. And so we really do appeal to all world leaders. Stop using lockdown as your primary control method. Develop better systems for doing it. Work together and learn from each other. But remember, lockdowns just have one consequence that you must never, ever belittle, and that is making poor people an awful lot poorer. Now, that wasn't written or spoken by one of the many local anti-lockdown activists, by Professor David Nabarro, the world's highest-ranking expert on COVID-19. He has said that the World Health Organization doesn't advocate lockdowns. Professor Nabarro dropped this bombshell in an interview with Andrew Neil for Britain's Spectator TV. Nabarro is the WHO's special envoy on COVID-19 and directly advises the organization's director general. And as much of the world gears up for a second round of lockdowns and restrictions on everyday life grow ever tighter, a group of infectious disease epidemiologists and public health scientists have come together to propose an alternative. The Great Barrington Declaration was spearheaded by Martin Kulldorff from Harvard Medical School, Sunetra Gupta from Oxford University, and Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford University Medical School. And it's named after the place it was signed, famed as the best small town in America, Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The declaration believes that those who are at low risk of dying from COVID-19 should be allowed to live their lives and enjoy freedoms that are now restricted. Well, we're joined now by Professor Kulldorff, who is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, a biostatistician and epidemiologist in the division of pharmacoepidemiology and pharmacoeconomics at Brigham and Women's Hospital. His research centers on developing and applying new disease surveillance methods for post-market drug and vaccine safety surveillance and for the early detection and monitoring of infectious disease outbreaks. And two of the three prominent South Africans who have lent their support to the declaration, financial services entrepreneur Magda Verzeka, founder of Signia, and Nick Hudson of think tank Panda. Professor Kulldorff, quite an extraordinary about turn from the World Health Organization, which we'll come to. But firstly, can you just tell us what led up to the formulation of the Great Barrington Declaration and what prompted you and your colleagues to make this public stand now?
Well, it has been a very stunning 6 to 8 months observing the discussions about COVID-19. One of the basic public health principles is that we should never look only at one disease. We have to look at health as a whole, and we can't just look short-term, we have to look long-term. With the lockdowns, there has been enormous collateral damage throughout the world, different in different countries, but when you have lockdowns, you have fewer medical visits, so there's worse outcomes for cardiovascular disease. Childhood vaccination rates goes down. Cancer screenings are postponed or not being done. That doesn't lead to mortality this year, but somebody who would have survived 15, 20 years might now die 3 to 5 years from now. The mental health issues are enormous. And in many parts of the world, there are people who cannot afford to buy food. So children are going hungry, or in some cases even starving. So the collateral damage of the lockdowns are enormous and very tragic, and that needs to be taken into the equation. The other issue is that lockdowns are not the best way to deal with COVID-19. Lockdowns can push things in the future, but it's not going to make the disease go away. So if we want to minimize the death from COVID-19, the two things we should not do. We shouldn't do nothing, because if we do nothing, some old and some young will be affected, and then among the old, a lot of people are going to die. If we do a general lockdown or general preventive measures, then we push things in the future, but in the end, some old and some young are going to be infected. A lot of old are going to die. On the other hand, if we do a focused protection, so the difference in everybody can get the disease, everybody can get infected, but the difference in mortality is more than thousandfold between the old and the young. So if we can protect the old specifically and focus the protection of them, then what we can happen is a few old, because we can't do complete protection, but a few old are going to be affected and a few are going to die, but most infected are going to be among the young, and they're going to survive, because for children, for example, the risk is less than the annual influenza. And that, by shifting sort of the burden of infection from the old to the young, we are reducing mortality from COVID-19. So it has beneficial both in terms of COVID-19 and in terms of collateral damage to do a focus protection where we focus the protection on the old and other high-risk groups.
And if you look at that, when you define the vulnerable, how do you propose to protect the old and those with comorbidities?
So it depends on their living situation and their work situation. If they're in nursing homes or other care settings, what's critical is to unless the staff is already immune, to do frequent testing of staff as well as test the visitors. Also to reduce staff turnover. So those are key measures in that setting. In settings where they live alone or with other older people at home, it's important to help them with grocery shopping, other things, so that they do not have to be out and about as much as they otherwise would have to be. For people who are in their 60s or still working, the key is to make sure that they, if they cannot work from home, then maybe to provide the financial resources that they can take a 3 to 6 months sabbatical while the disease is transmitting among the younger. And then when there's enough immunity in the population, then they can sort of get back to normal and they are protected by the herd immunity.
Herd immunity is something that we saw the Director General of the World Health Organization come out and strongly question the media statement, which we'll come to. He says it's never been used to combat a pandemic in the past, and he questions whether or not herd immunity is an effective strategy. But Nick, I just want to bring you in here and make the link here between PANDA and the Great Barrington Declaration. I believe the doctor sits on your board. How was that first conversation sparked? How did you make the link with the scientists that form the bulk of the Great Barrington Declaration?
I think it's been a union many months in the making because, you know, we have been since May advocating a targeted approach, pointing out the incredible devastation and mortality that would flow from lockdowns. And over time in social media space, we gradually sorted out who else in the world was saying the same thing. And over time, we came to each other's attention. There's a process of getting to know the parties, building up some trust. And then we were very pleased to see Dr. Kuldorf and Dr. Gupta and Dr. Bhattacharya joining forces. And a couple of weeks before the Great Barrington Declaration was signed, we actually invited them to join PANDA's Scientific Advisory Board, which is something we desperately needed because although we've been working closely with professionals from the fields of medicine and epidemiology, in most cases, they've been unable or unwilling to put their names on, attach their names to our cause, because there's such a culture of cancelling such individuals and kicking them out of their institutions simply for holding opposing opinions. And that's particularly disturbing because, you know, if there's one side of this debate that has gone against the science, it's the pro-lockdown debate, the pro-lockdown side. You know, prior to coronavirus, it was the unanimous policy of the World Health Organization and the CDC and any number of epidemiological journalists and specialists, journals and specialists that lockdowns or quarantining of the healthy should simply never be undertaken. So we're delighted to have the professors on board with us. We're looking forward to working with them very closely to end some of this madness and to restore some sanity to the universe. And we'll be adding some more people to our advisory board in the next couple of weeks.
You say that, but the madness does continue. Magda, you're in the UK at the moment, in London, where the PM is running around proposing another lockdown in the face of what Dr. Kuldorf has just explained is very poor evidence and science behind lockdowns. Why do we see this becoming such a politicized issue from your perspective?
I think, you know, what we are now seeing is a bit of a doubling down. So I think it's a little bit ironic, you know, obviously South Africa, and I was in South Africa during the lockdown and, you know, between March to the beginning of August. And it was very clear from coming from investment and macroeconomic background, it was very clear to me right up front that this was the wrong strategy for an emerging market, you know, simply because obviously we're looking at the macroeconomic secondary effects. So it's everything from poverty, hunger, unemployment, you know, recession, and all the kind of macroeconomic factors associated with the devastation that a lockdown would cause. And, you know, I tried to take legal action, you know, I was told I would lose. But, you know, it's ironic now that, be it with hindsight, you know, the South African government seemed to have seen sense and has unlocked the economy. But unfortunately, that isn't helpful in the context of the fact that the developed world is going into a second lockdown right now, because I don't believe that South Africa will go into lockdown again. And yet, you know, we are leading this charge from South Africa. The developed markets, the politicians are panic-stricken. They are motivated by and pulled in different directions by different interest groups, as well as social media. And what you are seeing, you know, in the UK is completely that. We have Boris Johnson thrashing around, changing his mind, introducing ridiculous measures in a fragmented manner. And the problem we're facing with this lockdown situation is that as much as South Africa might have unlocked its economy, it's useless in the face of lockdowns with our major trading partners, where there is, you know, so much macroeconomic and economic disruption worldwide caused by politicians. And, you know, the one thing that I don't understand in all of this is how compliant people actually have been with laws introduced by politicians who, you know, 3 or 4, 8 months ago, you didn't necessarily support or have much respect for. All of a sudden, someone tells you there's a curfew, and everyone, like a sheep, goes home and stays at home from 6 o'clock. So even in the face of overwhelm, because, and again, you know, in March, maybe politicians had scope to panic because there was so little information on the table. In October, where we know exactly who the vulnerable are, we know exactly what works and what doesn't, we know what mortality rates are, I cannot believe that we are resorting back to the same strategies that were adopted in March, because there's no excuse any longer beyond stupidity and panic.
On that point, Dr. Kuldorff, the head of the World Health Organization believes that we still know very little, that we cannot be assured of any kind of herd immunity, and we are also not certain that lockdowns are ineffective. According to his media statement, the World Health Organization seems to be doubling down.
I thought it was a good message from the World Health Organization that we should not do lockdown, that do not urge countries to do lockdowns. So I think that was a very positive statement. In terms of herd immunity, it's very strange that after more than half a year in this pandemic, people still talk very strangely about it, because herd immunity is simply a scientific fact and phenomena that we know exists, just like gravity in physics. So, and with this pandemic, we're going to reach herd immunity sooner or later, whatever strategy we use. So it's not, it doesn't make sense to talk about a herd immunity strategy. That would be like two pilots discussing, well, we're now up in the air. Should we use the gravity strategy to get down on the ground? We will get down on the ground no matter what, in one way or the other. And it's the question of minimizing mortality and reaching the end of this pandemic with the minimum number of mortality. That should be our goal.
Dr. Kuldorff, the one thing that isn't clearly mentioned in the declaration is mass testing and contact tracing as tools here. It seems to be a major part of most government strategies. If you just look at Magda, you're in the UK, the British government has spent more on its contact tracing system than it spent on the 2012 Olympics. Do you think that this will work, or is it misguided?
Well, first of all, testing is important in some settings, like for protecting nursing homes and obviously in hospitals for treatment. But to do mass testing of asymptomatic school children or university students, there's no public health reason for that. And when it comes to contact tracing, that's a method that's critically important to combat certain infectious diseases. For example, when we had a few cases of Ebola in the United States. I know you didn't have anything in South Africa, but in the United States we had a few cases. In that situation, it's very important to isolate them and then to find out who have they met recently, and then do the contact tracing, which is to talk to them and then interview them and test them and maybe isolate them also. So contact tracing is a very important method to contain certain infectious diseases. So it's sort of an important toolbox that the epidemiologists have. But to think that it will work for a pandemic situation where there is already a lot of infections in the population, that's naive. And Dr. Bhattacharya wrote an excellent explanation of this in a journal, scientific journal called Inference Review, where it sort of outlines the argument. And also, it doesn't work for influenza, for example. Or before we had vaccines, it can't be used for things like measles or rubella or any other diseases. So for COVID-19, it's a futile effort to do contact tracing. Very early on, it could have some effect to slow things down. There were very few cases. And potentially, once it has ended, one could do it with certain flare-ups. But even that is very hard because there are so many asymptomatic cases and there are so many mildly symptomatic cases, which makes it very, very difficult.
The image of Sisyphus springs to mind, pushing that rock uphill in the face of something as virulent as COVID-19. Magda, I want to come back to the issue that you mentioned, that developed markets are now toying with locking down again. You don't think we will lock down again here in South Africa, but we're still operating under level one restrictions. We still have a national state of disaster that we're operating under. That's due to be reviewed or either end on the 15th or extended. What would you as a business leader like to see happen from here to do as much as we can to help revive the economy?
I think, you know, whatever the remaining lockdown measures remain should obviously be lifted. But I think, you know, by and large, South African economy is back to normal to the extent that it can be back to normal. And given our reliance on services and tourism, obviously there is a whole sector of the economy which is in a catastrophic situation at the moment, just because, you know, there are no tourists. And then our own incompetence in not being able to reopen the skies because the rules are kind of unclear around, you know, how to treat planes and aeroplane crews. I mean, that's just absurd. So, you know, as it stands at the moment, I think, you know, you need to tidy up this the unlocking of the economy, because they do remain these pockets of lockdowns which are ineffectual. Look, lockdown in South Africa was always going to be ineffectual. In fact, you know, if you look at South Africa, it's a Sweden. We had a lockdown of which affected possibly 10% of the population, the middle classes, which are teeny tiny in South Africa. 90% of our population in townships was in no position to lock down. So they never did. And if you actually look at the antibody test percentages that are coming out of townships, where they're testing HIV positive people, pregnant women, anything ranging from 45% to 60% that I've read of people and are testing positive for COVID-19, that basically means this disease has swept through South Africa. It is a lot more infectious and a lot more asymptomatic than we expected before. So as far as South Africa is concerned, I think government now will extend the state of disaster, because I think that gives them a tools to, you know, to play with should they wish to. But I don't think that we will go into further lockdowns. And I think that what remains for us to do is to just tidy up the loose ends and reopen everything. And obviously subject to social distancing, isolation of the vulnerable, and, you know, all the sensible hygiene measures that we need to take.
That seems to be premised on the fact that the government is taking the right advice, as unfortunately it seems we've lost Dr. Koldorf's line there, but we've only got a few minutes left. Nick, the fact that we've seen the reconfiguration of the Ministerial Advisory Committee, and if you believe the minister, quite coincidentally, those three voices who were quite critical are no longer part of the Ministerial Advisory Committee. It doesn't engender a lot of confidence that government is going to get rid of the national state of disaster or do an about turn anytime soon.
Yeah, I agree with you, Michael, that it's very disconcerting to have the good scientists moved off and all the lackeys staying on. This is we keep hearing from Professor Karim this ongoing fear-mongering regarding the deadly second wave. There have been no deadly second waves. We are not going to have a deadly second wave. If it's not that, it's the long-term effects. And all this stuff is incredibly duplicitous. At the same time, there are threats of local lockdowns and so on. And we hear that there is a massive pressure on the testing centers to increase the number of tests that they're doing, which we read as an effort to get a kind of European-style case-demic going on, where you have a lot of false positives being registered and no deaths. And so we're quite concerned about this kind of development. We do not think we're out of the woods yet. The scope for madness is still with us. And so we're not going to take our eye off that ball. We will not let them get away with the thing. It does have all the sort of the look and feel of an attempt to keep the state of disaster going. I don't think it makes any sense to do that. We need to free up this economy, end this ridiculous state of disaster, and get going.
Magda, if the state of disaster is extended, and you certainly are one of the few business leaders that have been prepared to speak out in the face of irrational decisions, what will you do?
Look, I honestly do believe that they will extend the state just simply because it gives them powers they didn't have before. But I don't necessarily agree that we are heading for further lockdowns. I think that there is a very strong realization, supported by unions, and don't underestimate the voices of unions in terms of government policy shaping. I think that there is a deep-rooted understanding that lockdown is not the right strategy for South Africa. And, you know, I also don't believe that there is a second wave. I don't believe there's a second wave in the UK happening. All that's happening in the UK is they're testing everybody. They're testing everything that moves. You know, they went testing in March. They're testing now. So they're picking up huge amounts of positives without necessarily the deaths happening. But I think that realization has dawned on South Africa. I think, you know, with we're heading for a contraction in GDP of over 8% this year. We're looking at 3 million jobs that have been lost as a consequence of this lockdown. We've already seen social unrest. There will be more. So I don't think this government has appetite for any more lockdowns. But again, it doesn't help us if the rest of the world is in a lockdown mode, because we are reliant on the rest of the world for trade and for growth.
Nick, final comment, and by all means, let's criticize and let's welcome debate on the issue and criticize governments and the World Health Organization, but we certainly need to improve our decision-making from here. What's the mission of PANDA from this point to ensure that there are better decisions made in the future, that global bodies, leaders are taking advice and we're led by the scientific evidence, free of any particular ideological persuasion?
Well, we've got a multi-pronged approach. So the first thing is just to do whatever we can to end the residual madness. So we've got a collective of doctors and lawyers to support those doctors in speaking out against the craziness that has gone on, this huge breach of medical good practice. We want to make sure that those institutions who were foolish enough to go along with the malarkey are taken on, and that they all have institutional change coming their way. We would like to see the constitutionality of these lockdowns challenged all over the world. We would like to basically inoculate society against future lockdowns. We don't think that they ever have a place in the arsenal of health professionals. And it's been just a terribly sad thing that's going to cause much more death and destruction than the disease ever threatened to. So there's a lot of work there for us. And, you know, part of that work is actually unpacking what happened. How did this happen that the whole world went mad at the same time and departed from decades of scientific practice? How did all the modelers all make the same mistakes, dramatically overestimating the impact at the same time and in the same way and in the face of evidence that told them at the time that they were wrong? And then continued, you know, that's been the frightening thing here. The NICD people are unrepentant. They overestimated the hospital and the healthcare resource demand by a factor of almost 20. And we've known that that's been the case for months, and they just keep on going on trying to rationalize, explain how wonderful they are because they chased away the influenza this season and that kind of thing. It's complete nonsense, and they've just been a miserable failure at every single level.
Lots of searching questions that we are left with. I'm reminded of what Dr. Nabarro said as well. We're going to see a doubling of child malnutrition over the course of next year thanks to children not accessing their meals at school. It's just one of the effects of lockdown that will be with us for years to come. That was Nick Hudson of Panda. We're also joined by Professor Martin Kulder from Harvard Medical School and Magda Verzeka, founder of Signia, talking about the Great Barrington Declaration and the lessons we've learned from a once-in-a-generation mistake.